filmmaker from Toronto, Daniel Bizarre. And he's going to tell us about fault-tolerant quantum dynamical decoupling.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here finally after not visiting for what must seem like way too long. This is indeed just before I leave. I'm going to be moving to warmer climates in a couple of weeks. So I'd like to tell you about joint work with my student Kaveh Gupta right here. The first version was posted back in the summer last year, and then recently we posted version 2 with significant modifications, as to put it diplomatically. What I will tell you about is what's captured in this version 2. And the subject is quantum dynamical decoupling, which is a method to try and overcome decoherence traditionally. Has its origins in NMR, one could say, dates all the way back to the spin echo effect, which was discovered by Urban Hahn in the 50s and won the Nobel Prize, and then was imported into quantum computing, quantum information, with various modifications, initially by Viola and Lloyd, and then developed and refined by many others. And what I'll tell you about today is yet another refinement, which, however, we believe introduces an important improvement, and that is that we have some kind of rudimentary fault tolerance built into the dynamical decoupling procedure. Okay, so here is a brief outline of what I'll talk about. First, let me very quickly remind you about the context of open quantum systems and decoherence, and then I'll cover all these other things. So what is the context of the problem that I'm interested in? We have a system coupled to an environment, and we are trying to make that system evolve in a coherent manner so that we can, for example, quantum compute with it. And there's a Hamiltonian which describes this universe, which consists of the internal system Hamiltonian, a control Hamiltonian, which is at our disposal, and then there is the vast Hamiltonian, and then there is a system vast interaction with S being the system operator, V being the vast operator. And as we all know very well, HSV, that part over there, causes decoherence, i.e. non-unitary evolution, due to entanglement with the vast. That is one source of errors. And the other source of errors is that we are limited in the extent to which we can make the control Hamiltonian do what we want it to do. So instead of having some kind of idealized control Hamiltonian, what we have is the real control Hamiltonian is composed of the ideal part, and then there is an additional stochastic and/or systematic component, which I'll denote by W or a wiggle that is introduced on our control, and which is beyond our control. And with this control Hamiltonian, the realistic one that includes these noise terms, we then try to generate a control pulse. And that is a very generic situation. It includes essentially anything we try to do in quantum computing. That control pulse is then generated in terms of the total Hamiltonian. It is not generated just by the control Hamiltonian plus the wiggle part is generated by everything that is on at that time. And this is, of course, an important point, the Hamiltonian that we have to work with is the Hamiltonian of that particular universe, and it's not possible to just turn off terms here at will. And we have to work to make that happen. And the tools we have at our disposal are essentially these kind of pulses. So the question is, how do we overcome both the decoherence problem and the problem of faulty controls? Of course, that's an old question, and it's been addressed through a variety of methods listed here. But actually, it would be fair to say that only the method of quantum aircraft and codes, and perhaps the more recent ideas on continuous feedback control, really address, or claim to address, or partially address the problem of simultaneous decoherence and faulty controls, whereas the other two methods that are listed here, which were designed to overcome decoherence, decoherence of subspaces, and the subject of today, the number of coupled pulses, really didn't deal very well with the problem of the faulty controls.
Is there an assumption that the fields used to implement the control system don't influence the path?
They do influence the path. I didn't write that down explicitly, but yes, it just makes the problem worse.
So in which terms? In the last terms?
So one way you would see that is if you actually try to expand this this exponential here, in a Taylor expansion or a Mengs or a Campbell-Hausdorff expansion, you would see commutators arising between non-vanishing commutators.
Okay, so I mean
those various terms.
I mean those direct inputs of the bus. Obviously, they would indirect.
Right. Indirect. Yeah. I suppose you could make it even worse and say that the control terms never act exclusively on the system. So let's say I'm not dealing with that problem. It's bad enough. So what I want to do today is tell you about, as I said in the introduction already, I want to tell you about how we can potentially make dynamic decoupling pulses fault tolerant. And this will also have implications for the use of decoherency subspaces, because as it turns out, decoherency subspaces rely on symmetries in the interaction between system and bath, and these symmetries don't come for free. But there is a way that you can generate these symmetries, and you can generate them by using dynamical decoupling pulses. So these two work very well together. In fact, you can think of any number of combinations here, but these two work particularly nicely together. So what I will say about dynamical decoupling pulses also helps in the theory of decoherence subspaces. And in fact, the bottom line will be that these two methods together form a pretty complete means of overcoming decoherence in the presence of faulty controls, as long as we're dealing with non-Markovian baths. So baths that have some memory. And in order to deal with Markovian baths, we cannot use dynamical decoupling pulses. They're not applicable, and the reasons for that I will come back to later. Okay, so now let me very quickly review what dynamical decoupling pulses are in perhaps the simplest setting that they were proposed. And it is as follows. This is an example of dynamical decoupling pulses. You have a free evolution of system and bath coupled together. So by free, I mean you don't do anything. You don't apply any kind of controls for some period tau, which is followed by a pulse, and then again free evolution, and then again a pulse, and again free evolution, etc. Now, if you're clever about the way that you choose these pulses, the p's here, p and p dagger, in particular, if you choose your pulses such that they put a minus sign on the Hamiltonian, or in other words, if the pulse is anti-commutative of the Hamiltonian, then what you've induced is time reversal. Right? If you put a minus sign on the Hamiltonian, that's exactly like time reversal. Now, it's easy to see that if you evolve a system forward in time, then backward in time, then forward and backward, on average, things cancel out. So if you could time reverse the system bath evolution, you would be able to negate the coupling between system and bath, and you would essentially overcome the decoherence problem. So if you want, you can actually prove this in a one-line calculation. And what you will find is that this pulse sequence that I wrote it here, so free evolution followed by a pulse, free evolution followed by a pulse, because of the minus sign in the Hamiltonian, you can flip the pulses inside the exponential, as done here. Then the Hamiltonian gets a minus sign. Okay, so this minus sign here disappears, and these two things multiply together, give you the identity. So that's proof that forward-backward evolution cancels any evolution, and that's why this time reversal paradigm is extremely useful if you want to eliminate decoherence. Of course, this picture is highly idealized, and I will relax the idealized assumptions later on. Now here's a specific example that shows how this might work for
let's say, a single qubit undergoing dephasing, coupled too long to a bath. So, what do you say here? Is that or is he?
It's an institute. Add to just mentioned this. I don't know what I'm going to throw off. Forgive me if I oscillate with you. So this is the Pauli sigma z matrix times some bath operator with some coupling constant lambda. That's the Hamiltonian that induces pure dephasing. And if you wanted to cancel this kind of interaction, pure dephasing interaction, what you would do is you would apply Pauli sigma x pulses in exactly that manner. And because x and z energy commute, you get the final reversal effect, and indeed, and the math interactions average to zero in first order in some sense. Okay, so this in fact is just a specific instance of a much more general and rather elegant construction known as universal dynamical decoupling, and this was introduced in a paper by Viola, Knill, and Lloyd, and independently by Zanardi. And the idea is the following. Suppose we want to eliminate some arbitrary general system bath Hamiltonian. What we do is we choose some group of pulses, the so-called symmetrizing group, and we start applying these pulses with these group elements, all of them. So this is pulse, free evolution, inverse pulse, next pulse, free evolution, etc. And if you do the so-called Mannes expansion, which is a controlled way of calculating the overall effect of this product, what you would do is the first order Mannes expansion is you take the sum of all these terms and put them up in the exponential. This is a first order approximation, a bit like a Taylor expansion, but things go up into the exponential. And one can systematically derive a second order and higher order terms. So now you see right away that if you choose these group elements appropriately such that this sum is zero, then you're done. So the dynamical decoupling condition, or the first order dynamical decoupling condition, is precisely that, that this sum is zero, which is equivalent to a projection into the commutant of this group. Okay, and then, and so that's the general idea behind dynamical decoupling. And in our case, for today's purposes, all I will need is one particular simple group, which namely the Pauli group on a single qubit. So the group I'll be dealing with is just the group of identity sigma z sigma sigma x. And in that case, this general construct here reduces to this form. And if you multiply out the Pauli matrices, you get a slightly shorter pulse sequence. And this pulse sequence eliminates any arbitrary system bath interaction on a single qubit. Okay, because the most general coupling to a single qubit involves a Pauli operator on that qubit. And this group will project any Pauli operator to zero. Okay, so that's why it's called universal dynamical decoupling. And the standard way in which universal dynamical decoupling has been applied is to just take this pulse sequence and now just throw it at this system bath in a periodic manner. So you take this pulse sequence and you just repeat it as often as you need in a periodic manner. And that's essentially the end of the story of periodic dynamical decoupling, the way things have been done as so far. And in fact, they have been done in NMR for 50 years now. Yes.
So as a result of these pulses, aren't you changing also the main Hamiltonian that you want to do computation?
Yes.
Yes. So you need to do some sort of correction after all? Or?
Yeah, I will come to that towards the very end. But yes, absolutely, you're right. If you want to compute, then obviously this pulse sequence is going to eliminate your control Hamiltonian as well. The one for the computation Hamiltonian, and so you have to be more clever about it. But so what I'm talking about now, and actually what I'll talk about almost until the very end, is just doing memory, not computation.
Okay, can I ask for a point of clarification? If the GIs are x, y, z, and I, then, I don't know, my impression is that that'd be a completely depolarizing channel. So why would it take the system path, that'll tell you to zero.
So, first of all, the group here is being applied. It's not the system path interaction that this group describes. Okay, so it's, when you say the polarizing channel, I'm getting suspicious that maybe you're confusing what this group is about. This is not the this group doesn't describe the system path interaction. Describe what you're going to do to the system, right?
So my impression was that your little GIs in the box equation, you know, in this particular example, it would be x, that the x poly, the y poly, the z, and identity. So there's four terms in that sum, the sum over I. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so if you just, you know, whatever, if it's not HSP, if it's any operator A, if you say I have a sum over, you know, the actions of the four polys, then that's, my impression was that would take everything to the mixed state.
If you get the identity, then you don't have any system.
So it's not zero, it's identity.
No.
It's
zero.
It's the Hamiltonian that you're mixing down on identity.
So when you mix Hamiltonian, it goes to zero rather than identity?
Right.
Yeah. What?
Right or that wrong. Right. E to the zero equals one.
What's that?
E to the zero equals one.
Just try that.
See, man. Plug an X in here and see if you get zero. Someone tries that with a polygon. You should. If not, then I'll talk later. Don't bother me during the talk with that. Okay, so, all right. So what I told you so far is the idealized version of the story. Now what happens if you're working with real, i.e. faulty pulses? Okay, so that again is the ideal picture that I already described before. But the real situation is that we don't just have the control Hamiltonian on while the pulse is on, we have everything on while the pulse is on. Okay, so what we have on while the pulse is on is this ideal control Hamiltonian, but we also have this wiggle term, which is the intrinsic noise in our apparatus. And then we have the system bath interaction, we have the bath interaction. Everything is on while the pulse is on. And when the pulse is off, well, then we have the system bath interaction and the bath Hamiltonian. That's what's on. Okay, so this is the situation in real life. And you immediately see that this introduces problems because unlike this ideal case where I assume that only my control Hamiltonian was on, in this case, nothing commutes necessarily with anything else. Okay, so all of these terms may not commute with each other. And intuitively, well, that is bound to give problems, and indeed it does. And it shows up as errors in the second order part of the Magnus extension. Okay, and this the same problem, of course, is also true in the context of fault tolerant quantum error correction, this kind of problem is considered in the setting of fault tolerance, where just assume that the pulses are imperfect. Okay, so how can we, just to get a handle on this effect of working with imperfect pulses, how can we visualize it? So. This is an attempt to try to give you a geometrical meaning of what's going on. Let's take the bad guy, which is the system bath Hamiltonian plus the bath Hamiltonian. Let me call it HD. And imagine it as a vector in a two-dimensional plane, in a plane, which has axes labeled by whatever commutes with our pulse versus whatever anti-commutes with our pulse. Okay, so for a qubit, you can always do that. For a qubit, it's a property of the Pauli group on a single qubit that anything either anti-commute any Pauli operator either anti-commutes or commutes with another Pauli operator or a linear combination. So we indeed have a two-dimensional plot for a qubit, and the effect of decoupling is to eliminate the part that anti-commutes with the pulse. Right? The part that anti-commutes, remember, that's what gives time reversal. Right? The time reversal condition was an anti-commutation condition between the bath, system bath interaction and the pulse that we're applying. So ideal dynamical decoupling eliminates the part that anti-commutes, but leaves the part that commutes. So what happens is in ideal dynamical decoupling, you get a projection onto this axis. Okay, so this is the action of ideal dynamical decoupling, just a projection onto the parallel component of the error Hamiltonian.
But in the non-ideal scenario where we have control errors, what happens is that there is a rotation back up here due to these second order Magnus effects. Okay, so you'll have to believe me that this is what happens. So instead of getting an ideal cancellation of the part that Antic commutes, the second order errors rotate us back up into this plane, and we have a residual component here. And it's really a projection plus rotation. You can actually work it out. If you work out the effect of these second order Magnus terms, you get a correction term here, which has precisely the form of this is the parallel part, and you see there's a rotation here being applied with the perpendicular part. Okay, so this geometric picture that I'm giving is actually quite accurate, up to third order in, well, a complicated looking small parameter, which involves the pulse interval and then the norms of these two components of the halotonic. Okay, so the important thing to remember is what happens in non-ideal dynamical decoupling is you have not just a projection, you also have a rotation back up. And this is what gives you errors. And these errors are going to accumulate if you don't do something about it.
All right, and so that the dp of HE term, so that's the parallel thing to order tau, and then the correction is order tau squared?
It's all I can say. I'm not sure that what you're saying is right. All I can say is that this is the term up to order lambda squared, where lambda is defined through here. Okay, so this includes second order effects in tau. This is up to tau squared.
Okay.
That rotation.
But you're not sure that the first order.
The first order term is there, but it's the first order term is taken care of by first order Magnus expansion, and that first order term is gone. So it is the first order term in tau is strictly gone if you apply this pulse. What you're left with is the second order term. That's what this term is, and then the zero order corrections.
Well, that term also includes the zero order, the parallel part.
The zeroth order.
The zeroth order is a parallel part. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. So what this picture gives you is the following intuition that you see that this geometric progression here is one in which the norm shrinks, right? A projection followed by a rotation like this is a norm-decreasing map of the error halotonic. So intuitively, we know that we're on the right track with dynamical decoupling, even in the presence of control errors. We are shrinking, we are reducing the norm of the error halotonic. That's the kind of effect that we want. It's just that it's not being reduced enough. So the idea we had was to try to borrow the successful procedures of quantum error correction, Poincaré quantum error correction, namely, specifically, the idea of concatenation. So perhaps there's a way to continue to eliminate the error term here by concatenating pulse sequences. And it's going to have to be in time here, because we don't have a spatial direction. All we're doing is pulse sequences in time. And if we could do that, then we could somehow continue to shrink the norm of this error Hamiltonian, and then it would be done. Okay, so that's what the rest of the talk is going to be about. It's about this idea of concatenating dynamical decoupling pulse sequences. So first, very briefly, why is concatenation useful in the context of error correcting codes? Well, very roughly, the story is that if you start with the lowest level encoding, let's say a 3-qubit code with respect to bit flips, with an effective error probability p, when you go to the next level in concatenation, then roughly, effectively, the error goes from p to p squared, and then at the next level it goes to p to the 2 squared, et cetera, et cetera. And at the nth level of concatenation, the error
becomes very small, super exponentially small, while the code only increases exponentially. So if, and I confess this is a very rough argument, but it sort of captures what's going on. And then there's a critical key where this procedure, if you apply this procedure, you're going to win. The super exponential decrease in the probability of error is going to beat the exponential increase in resources that you need. So our idea was to try to borrow this in the context of dynamical coupling pulses. And rather than do this concatenation in space, we have to do it in time. So how would we do this concatenation? Well, let's take the elementary universal dynamical decoupling pulse sequence, which I wrote down before. So remember, I just took the poly group, multiplied out all the various terms, and arrived at this slightly compressed pulse sequence. And let's call this P1. And now, at the next level of concatenation, we are going to take this P1 pulse sequence, and wherever there was a free evolution, we're going to stick in the original P1. Okay, so that's the recursive construction. Replace every free evolution period with the original pulse sequence. So you can do that recursively. Whenever you see an F, when you expand this out, wherever you see an F, you plug in P2, and et cetera, et cetera. So if you write out the pulse sequences thus obtained, well, this is what they look like. This is the original universal dynamical coupling pulse sequence. This is the second order concatenation, third order concatenation, et cetera. Of course, the thing grows exponentially. And now the question is our intuition correct that this concatenated recursive structure is going to help us in fighting the control errors? Yes.
Just a clarification, I guess you're keeping the time slices constant.
Yeah, so there's a choice to be made here. Are you going to keep the overall experiment time fixed and decrease the pulse interval? Or are you going to keep the pulse interval fixed and increase the overall experiment time? In practice, of course, what you're really limited by is how short you can make the pulse intervals and how short you can make the pulses themselves. So realistically, what you'll do is you, for the lowest level here, you will pick the shortest possible pulse duration and pulse interval, and then you'll start building this thing out. So you make your experiment longer and longer. Okay, so first, a little bit of the analytical results. This concatenated pulse sequence can be analyzed analytically, and we've done it, and it's somewhat lengthy, and I'm not going to bother with any details. I'll give you the bottom line. So the intuition is that concatenation helps, because here again is this geometric picture. The lowest level concatenation, i.e. the elementary universal decoupling pulse sequence, does this, right? There was a projection followed by rotation. But now, if you concatenate, recursively concatenate this the pulse sequence, what is going to happen, as can be shown rigorously, is that this procedure continues. Projection again, rotation again. And then again, projection, rotation, and you see that this is going to indeed do the job of continuously shrinking, constantly shrinking the effective, the norm of the effective system bath interaction. But the question is, how quickly does this happen? And because at the same time, we're exponentially growing our pulse sequence. So are we gaining anything by doing this? And in particular, are we gaining by, in comparison to the periodic pulse sequence? So, I will give you a summary of the analysis, which compares the performance of concatenated versus periodic, and then I'll tell you about simulation results, which are easier to look at. So our analysis proceeds under the following assumptions. Here we have a single qubit. This is the error Hamiltonian, so this is the bath, pure bath, and this is the system bath interaction. And for simplicity, let's assume that it's this term which is the largest. Okay, so B0 is larger, the norm of B0 is larger than any of the B alphas over there. Or if you wish, you can
read the results that are coming just in terms of the maximum of these norms of D0 or DX, DY, and DZ. And we also need to assume that the norm of V0 times the total experiment time, capital P is the total experiment time, is some fixed number much smaller than 1. Okay, so this is a severe technical assumption because we are growing our total experiment time exponentially. Right? So by imposing this constraint, we're essentially imposing that our bath is becoming weaker and weaker. And we do this because we don't know how to handle it otherwise in terms of the analytics. This kind of assumption in the simulations is not going to show up. So what I'm telling you is kind of a analysis under severe assumptions, but at least that we can do, and then we get a result. Okay, so let me compare the lack of fidelity or the infidelity of concatenated pulse sequences versus periodic pulse sequences after the maximum number of concatenation levels allowed by fixing C. Okay, so if I fix C and I fix the norm of V0, that gives me a maximum experiment time, and that gives me an upper concatenation level. So I'm fixing C and V0, and that's what these results are. The infidelity for the concatenated sequence over the infidelity of the periodic sequence is bounded by the following expression. So you want this infidelity to be as small as possible. Okay, and the result we have is that the concatenated pulse sequence outperforms the periodic pulse sequence in a super polynomial manner. Okay, so it might be a bit hard to look at this and immediately understand what it says, but this indicates a super polynomial advantage, this logging exponential as opposed to just a square. In particular, you can just take the limit, the physically meaningful limit of tau going to 0. Tau is the pulse interval. And in the limit of tau going to 0, this goes to 0, which means that the infidelity of the concatenated pulse sequence goes to 0 much faster than the infidelity of the periodic pulse sequence. So the concatenated pulse sequence strictly outperforms the periodic pulse sequence under the assumptions stated here. Okay, so there we have an analytic result that shows that we might expect an advantage for concatenated pulse sequences. Now, why is there this difference? I already hinted at it. Let me say it explicitly now. What happens in the periodic pulse sequences is that you repeat a certain pulse sequence periodically, and the second order turns into Magnus expansion. Keep building up. Okay, so you apply the pulse sequence once, and there's a second order error that you didn't take care of. Now you apply the same pulse sequence again, and that second order error is still there, but they add up. And after several applications of the pulse sequence, this error becomes pretty big, and eventually it just doesn't work anymore. So in other words, in the periodic pulse sequence, there's no mechanism built in that will fix the second order errors that are building up. Whereas in the concatenated pulse sequence, this recursive structure, just like in the analogy to concatenated error correction, we have something built in which is designed to eliminate the errors as they build up. And that mechanism works. That is essentially what is shown by this formula. But it doesn't work under arbitrary conditions. There's essentially something which I really shouldn't call a threshold, but there's a condition for these concatenated pulse sequences to actually give you an advantage, which roughly can be extrapolated from here. Let me not give you the explicit formula. Okay, so bottom line is concatenated pulse sequences have a built-in correction mechanism which periodic pulse sequences do not. That's why we expect them to work better. And now to test it under more realistic conditions, because as I said, the theory that we've done is involves severe approximation. So we wanted to see if we could apply this to a realistic system without making any approximations. So what we did was we took a system of interest in solid state quantum computing, namely a single spin, so that's number one here, coupled to a bath of other spins. So this is the bath, pure bath Hamiltonian. And the coupling between system and bath is through a Heisenberg interaction. So what this is a model for, this is a pretty good model for proposals involving spin and quantum dots, like the loss of intensive proposal, or the cane architecture, where you have a phosphorus, the phosphorus nucleus providing your qubit, and it's coupled to a bath of other nuclear spins. So whenever you have whenever you have a spin qubit coupled to a bath of other spins, that is what this Hamiltonian describes very well. And we numerically exactly solve the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so no approximation here. And we calculated as error measure the lack of purity. Okay, so if the system is perfectly corrected, then purity would be 1, or the lack of purity would be 0. Now note that this is a non-Markovian bath. We're solving the exact Schrodinger equation in this case, so we're not making any assumptions about baths with decaying memory time. So this is actually the setting in which dynamical decoupling applies, non-Markovian. And what I'll show you is a comparison between the pulse-free evolution, so this is just for calibration, when you don't do anything, versus the concatenated pulse sequence and the periodic pulse sequence. Okay, and we hope that the concatenated pulse sequence is going to outperform certainly the free evolution and also the periodic pulse sequence. And all this is done subject to faulty controls and limited switching time. So in other words, we'll have a minimum pulse interval tau, and there will be a minimum pulse width also. Okay, so here are the results. First, as a function of the strength, the system bath interaction strength. So on this axis is the lack of purity on a log 10 scale. Okay, so the lower the better here. And on this axis is the number of concatenation levels going from 0 to 6. And on this axis is the system bath coupling strength. Okay, so the larger is J, and the stronger is the coupling between system and bath. And there's a comparison here between the concatenated sequence and the periodic sequence. Okay, so first of all, just to calibrate you, I notice that here the lack of purity goes all the way down to minus 15, here it goes down to minus 12. And you see that as you increase the concatenation level, so the red dots are the highest level of concatenation, which here just means a very long pulse sequence. The concatenated pulse sequences perform better and better as they become more concatenated. And in addition, indeed, they start outperforming the periodic pulse sequence until at level 6 concatenation. Well, see for yourself what the numbers are. Okay, so this goes up to about minus 5, and this goes up to about minus 15. It's actually pretty constant over that range of couplings. Okay, so as a function of system bath interaction strength, the concatenated pulse sequence is clearly doing a lot better. Oh, and I should say this is for a bath of 5 spins. That's already a pretty large orbit space. And the pulse width, which is 10 to the minus 4 of the total pulse sequence. Now, the next comparison is when we introduce systematic noise. Okay, so now we're keeping the system bath coupling fixed. And again, we have 5 bath spins. And now what we're doing is we are introducing noise, systematic noise, onto our pulses. By systematic noise, I mean that every pulse gets some random error. So if it's an X pulse, I add some random component to it. If it's a Y pulse, add another random component to it. But that random component, once chosen, is fixed throughout the whole pulse sequence. Okay, and that's what I call systematic. So you pick a random error, and then you keep it fixed throughout the entire pulse sequence. So now the axis here is the strength of this systematic noise over the strength of the actual Hamiltonian. Okay, so over here, one means that the noise is as strong as the Hamiltonian itself. So that's very, very strong noise. And you see that the concatenated pulse sequences get better as you increase the concatenation level until they reach, well, this is as far as the simulations went. And it, already here at the fourth level of concatenation and fifth and sixth, you see that it sort of flattens out. And then, well, there's a flat part, and then there, it starts to rise. So it suggests that there's some kind of a threshold behavior going on here. And whether there's really a threshold, that we haven't been able to prove yet, but certainly these simulations indicate that these pulse sequences are capable of tolerating noise up to some level, and then they start going down. Now, how about the comparison to the case of periodic sequences? So this is at fixed concatenation level, so we have a pulse sequence roughly 4 to the power 5 pulses here. This is just to calibrate. This is if you do nothing. Okay, if you do nothing, the system baffling traction is still on, so the system becomes impure. If you apply a periodic pulse sequence versus if you apply a concatenated pulse sequence, and you see that, again, as a function of systematic noise, you see that there's a large range of values for which the concatenated pulse sequence outperforms the periodic pulse sequence. And then at very high noise levels, it's about as good as doing nothing. Okay, now, what about random noise? So random noise, again, we fix the coupling between system and DAF. And we now take every pulse and perturb it randomly. And that random perturbation changes from pulse to pulse throughout the entire pulse sequence. Okay, so as opposed to the systematic case where we choose a perturbation, but then we keep it fixed throughout the pulse sequence. Okay, so in this case, we can go to very high noise levels. We can only go up to about 5% noise level. Or what is that, actually 2.5% noise level here. But still, concatenation helps. It improves your fidelity. The more you concatenate, the better the fidelity in the presence of these random errors. And how does it compare to doing nothing and doing periodic pulse sequences? So here you see the results for level 4 concatenation. And you see that the concatenated pulse sequences, again, outperform the periodic pulse sequences over a range. And there's an interesting thing going on here. The periodic pulse sequences actually get better as you add more noise to them for a while. And then they flatten out. OK, so that may seem puzzling. But in fact, it's not that puzzling. A periodic pulse sequence, if you add noise to it, what you're doing is you can think of it as averaging over the sphere. Right? So instead of averaging over three directions, which is what the periodic pulse sequence does, when you add random noise to it, you perform an averaging not just over these three perpendicular directions, but rather over the entire sphere. And averaging over the sphere is still a useful operation. It tends to cancel the appearance to some extent. This has actually been recently made rigorous. There were a couple of papers, a recent PRL by Viola and Knill, in which they analyzed the performance of random decoupling sequences and showed that indeed there is a range where they work, where they help. And there was some other paper addressing the same subject. So while this may seem at first surprising, actually, it is expected for periodic pulse sequences. Not true for the concatenated pulse sequences. They have too much structure. You don't want to mess with that structure by randomizing it. And then if the noise is too high, well, then they become pretty similar. There is so much noise at this point that essentially the pulse sequence is random, whether it's concatenated or periodic. Okay, and so I've basically shown you all of the simulation results. So now let me move on very quickly to generalizations and implications of all these results. So there was a question early on
What about the computation? Can we compute in the presence of these pulses? Now, what I've shown you so far is that you can help, that you can use these pulses to eliminate decoherence in the context of memory. But if you want to compute, these pulses may interfere, if you're not being careful, the pulses may interfere with the actual computational operations. Okay, so how can you overcome this? Well, one idea, and this is at this point just an idea, which needs to be worked out more, is to borrow further from the structure of error correction, in particular from stabilizer codes. And the idea is the following. Instead of working with bare unencoded qubits, let's move to an encoding. In particular, let's use a stabilizer code. And let's apply pulses, which are not just the simple polyloop pulses. Instead, let's use as pulses elements of the stabilizer of that particular stabilizer code. Now, why is that a good idea? Because we know from the construction of stabilizer codes that the elements of the stabilizer anti-commute with the errors that this code is supposed to correct. And anti-commutation, if you remember, is exactly this time reversal condition. Right? So if you apply pulses that anti-commute with your errors, that's like time reversing. Okay, so if we encode and use stabilizer pulses, then the errors that this code can correct in the context of quantum error correction, these errors will be time reversed, and hence these errors will be eliminated by these stabilizer pulses. Okay, so there is a class of errors that are going to be eliminated by these kind of pulses, but I'm talking about computation. Now, why does this help for computation? Because now when we're using stabilizer pulses, we can use elements of the normalizer to compute. Because the normalizer, by construction, commutes with the stabilizer. So these normalizer pulses can be used as computational pulses without being eliminated by our stabilizer pulses. They commute. Okay? Now, of course, normalizer pulses are insufficient for universal quantum computing. So this whole thing has to be supplemented with something else to make it universal, but at least this looks like a step in the right direction. And exactly how to complement it to get a universal set that's still open. Okay, so that's one idea, how to move up the computation. Another idea is what was mentioned early on, which was to, I guess, systematically correct for the computational errors introduced by the pulses, or if you wish to apply the pulses slowly enough such that the computational pulses can just be inserted in a kind of a stroboscopic fashion. That's another possibility. And yet, another possibility is to combine concatenated pulses with so-called composite pulses, which I don't have time to go into. So if you know about composite pulses from NMR, then I think you'll understand what I mean here. Okay, so to finish, let me conclude. What this work has shown is that there's an advantage to using concatenated, i.e. recursively nested pulse sequences over periodic and standard periodic pulse sequences. Our analytical results show that this is strictly advantageous at equal cost. And the numerical results indicate that there is additional robustness that is gained against both systematic and random control errors, and also that we have improved performance over a wide range of system bath couplings. Now, as far as I'm concerned, where this work started was in trying to improve the prospects for decoherence-free subspaces. And now that we have these robust pulse sequences, which are fault tolerant to some extent, we can use them also to that end, namely, we can use these pulse sequences to generate symmetries. And then once we have the symmetries, we can encode into decoherence-free subspaces and use those for robust information storage. All of this is going to work against non-Markovian noise. And the reason is that dynamical coupling relies on time reversal. And time reversal is only possible if the bath hasn't forgotten. You cannot time reverse a bath that has totally forgotten. There's nothing to time reverse. So roughly speaking, this is why all of this applies only in the non-recoding context where the balance still has some memory, and you can exploit that memory to time reverse the evolution of the bath, of the system and the bath. So wherever there are Markovian errors, this method does not apply at all. And in that case, we definitely still need another method, such as quantum Lamprecht encodes. So I don't know if there are any experimentalists in the audience. I doubt it here. But talk to your experimentalist friends and tell them that all they need to do is implement this pulse sequence and something good will come out of it. Thanks for your time.
Questions? David?
Yeah, this distinction that you're making between Markovian and non-Markovian. I mean, you can always, if you have a non-Markovian environment, you can always like embed it in a larger environment and just say that this thing is Markovian.
How do you physically embed it? I don't mean that as a mathematician, but as an experimental physicist, how do you do this embedding?
Well, my point is that, I mean, in your model, for example, I guess it was just a matter of the trade-off or the relative strength of the bath envelope and the coupling length. That's all that really matters. I mean, because you have this large environment and it's just a bunch of spin, and as you said, there's an exchange interaction between each of these spins. So you can imagine that this exchange interaction is just bringing fresh new qubits next to the system every time. So there is no